I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, and this week from Cuba. An American conversation with global attitude is what we call open source, and it's exactly what we're having in Havana for the next 50 minutes or so, with three very American young women becoming doctors in the Cuban style through 5 or 6 years training at the Latin American Medical School in Havana. It was wild serendipity that we met them at all. Our producer, Paul McCarthy, was standing at a bus stop when he heard a laugh. "Only Akua Brown laughs like that," he blurted out. And Akua Brown it was, whom he had known in high school in the Bay Area of California a dozen years ago, but hadn't seen for a decade. So over the next few days, Akua Brown and two of her friends from the States poured out their immersion in Cuban life and slang, Cuban sexism and racism, Cuban boyfriends and families, their own student volleyball, and, by the way, this strange Cuban thing about toilet seats and toilet paper. The revolution seems to frown on both. But most of the talk here is about medicine, the Cuban way. It's famous in the Caribbean. Some argue it's the best in the world. For sure, it has shaped the skills and the visions of these women who will come back and apply it all in underserved communities at home in North America. We're talking in a lively, big chicken and rice restaurant in Havana toward the end of December 2008. Akua, Keisha, Carice, I love your story. Three very American girls in Havana learning how to be doctors. I just want you to tell me the story. How did this happen? Akua.
Well, I have always had an interest in medicine since a young age. I knew I wanted to be a doctor, but at the same time, I have always studied Spanish, had an interest in learning about other cultures and living in other parts of the world. So when I heard about this program through an interview on NPR, it was a perfect combination of all the goals that I had. And here I am, 4 years later.
What took you over the barrier in Cuban life, Cuban culture?
I think just time, you know, and building my community here in Cuba. I think that's the part that helped me feel like this really is my life. I spend 10 months of the year here and, you know, 2 months at home every year. And then coming to the realization that more of my life is spent here than it is spent in the United States. Starting to be a part of my life, what makes me as a person. As well.
This probably isn't the Spanish you learned in school. Were there language barriers, culture barriers, political barriers?
Yes. Cuban Spanish is very different from any Spanish I've ever heard anywhere. I live in California, so I do have a lot of experience with people from many Latin American countries. And I had one Cuban friend in the United States, and I didn't understand him when he spoke Spanish as well. I studied Spanish in college, and I thought that I spoke Spanish very well. But when I got here, I didn't understand what they were saying, and they didn't understand what I was saying, though we were speaking the same language, so to say, so to speak.
A doctor's got to be listening carefully, right?
Yes.
Doctor's got to hear everything.
And patients also have their own ways of speaking. I mean, communicating with professors is easy because they speak from the books, you know, it's by the books, and they know that we come from other countries and are careful to speak clearly with us. But speaking with patients, I mean, you know, there's slang for everything, and the slang differs by the region in Cuba that they're from. You know, so there's at least now I know 15 words for head alone. You know,
yeah. Carice Gale, tell us your story.
I am a Georgetown graduate, and my last year at Georgetown was the year that I was supposed to be applying to medical school. I had decided to take a year off and just work and kind of get my head together because I wasn't excited really about the programs that I was seeing in the United States. Financially, I wasn't prepared to take on the financial heartache, really.
What was the net cost of your American medical education going to be?
$120,000, and that's like the basis.
Okay.
So it would have gone up from there with living and living expenses and books and buying your lab coats and your, you know, everything. So a friend of mine was organizing a talk with a civil rights speaker at Georgetown, and I attended. He just so happened to have information about medical school in Cuba. A free scholarship sounded wonderful. And the opportunity to study abroad and learn about a different culture and about a different system. And also, I was familiar with the Cuban system because I'm Jamaican, my family is Jamaican, and the Cuban medical system is well known in Jamaica. And the quality of the education is well known in Jamaica. And so knowing all of these things, and it just, it fit. Coming here at that point in my life was what I needed to do, and to this day I know that I'm where I'm supposed to be, you know.
Keisha Guerrier, tell us your story.
I actually finished my college education in New York at the New York Institute of Technology, and it was May of 2005 exactly, and I knew that I wanted to study medicine. And my father was listening to the radio. He was listening to NPR, which he always does. And he heard Reverend Lucius Walker talking about the program. And my father's Haitian. He's originally from Haiti. And there are lots of Cuban doctors in Haiti. And Cuba actually has a program where they bring Haitian students to Cuba, teach them in their own dialect, and send them back to Haiti. So my father had always, being a Haitian man, known about the Cuban medical system and the Cuban people. And he knew I wanted to be a doctor. He knew I kind of spoke Spanish, enjoyed Spanish culture and dance and different things like that. And he said to me, you need to call this man. I didn't actually hear the program at all. He said, you need to call this man. And I did. And I held an audience with Reverend Walker, and I learned about the program. I later looked at it online and sent in my application. And in August of 2005, I was in Cuba. So it was just like, okay.
When did it kick in for you? When did you feel you were at cruising speed? You had mastered something of the culture? When did you feel at home?
My second year here. The first year was tears and more tears and struggle. And struggling with the Spanish, struggling with receiving all of the classes in Spanish, and then speaking to professors, speaking to people from Guatemala, Argentina, because it's not only Cubans that, you know, we as students have to relate to, but students from all over Central and South America, and the cultural clashes between us, between Americans and Panamanians, or Americans and Honduranians, Americans and Cubans. It was like a constant, this is not your country. And I'm like, well, it's not your country either, but we speak the language, so hold that down. Something sort of, kind of like really a fish out of water. And my second year when I came back, I actually played on a volleyball team at the school, and I was the only American on the team. And we got to travel to a couple of different provinces and play volleyball. And not only that, I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time in a Cuban community. I befriended an elderly lady that lives about maybe 3 miles from the school, and she was very open to come to my house, let me cook for you. I know you're a student, I know you're far from your family. Come have dinner with us, and you know, we'll take care of you. And that time that I spent inside of the Cuban community, I mean, with Cubans 24 hours a day, that's when it kicked in. Like, okay, I fit in here, and I'm doing well in school relatively, and I'm able to communicate, and I'm able to, you know, walk the streets as a Cuban. I'm able to live here, maybe not as comfortably as I would be living in the United States, but I'm able to be comfortable. I'm here, and I'm able to enjoy life here, not as a foreigner, not as a tourist, but as a person in Cuba. And I feel like one of the things that helped that is that when Cubans speak to you, some of them might speak to you as a tourist. Most of them will speak to you as a person, and they want to know about your experience, and they want to share their experiences for you, and they want to share their culture with you.
There's so many pieces here I'd like you all to comment on, but including the medical basis of what you're doing, the politics of it, the race of it, the Castro versus Uncle Sam aspect of it. One way to begin is simply, you know, so fascinating. Your father was the one who said, with a sophisticated Haitian understanding of things, who said, this is for you. But I wonder, family, friends, college classmates, you're going to Cuba?
Yes, that was the question.
Third world country, it's kind of a pain in the American neck.
I have a brother who constantly teases me. I know he's proud of me. I know he really is. Like, he's astounded by the work that I'm doing here and that my other classmates are doing here. But one of the things he always says to me is, so how are the Roman blackouts? And are you ducking yet? Are you ducking? Like, he's like, I'm like, it's not that bad. Like, most of my family is distinctly Caribbean. My father's from Haiti. My mother's from Guyana. They have an outside viewpoint of Cuba. Like, they don't really buy into what has been said about Cuba in the United States. So for the most part, the nuclear unit of my family, they're pretty much with me. But the extended family, I have some aunts that are like, come home now, please. And friends that are like, oh, that's totally cool. I mean, on your way out, just pick me up a box of cigars. Like, completely not interested in it because they don't really believe in what we're doing. They don't understand how it works. They don't feel that. What I've gotten a lot of is that it's not for free. Don't think it's free. You're going to have to give something back. And it's true, we do have to give something back. As they're saying, we have to serve our communities. But they're thinking, no, you're going to be in debt to the Cuban government. There's an ulterior motive here, and you're just a pawn in this game that this, like, the Cuban government is playing. And I feel really strongly against that statement. I mean, there are a lot of things that the Cuban government has done that some people might agree with and might not agree with. But in terms of medicine, in terms of community health, in terms of the practice of medicine here, that's one of the things that they got right. They hit it right on the nose. They hit the nail on the head. And I feel that this offer that was given out was a pure, without any ulterior, I don't think there was any ulterior motive in that. I mean, I'm sure that it's like, no, actually, I really do. I really feel that the people who instituted this program saw how it works in Cuba. They saw how it works in Cuba. They know how the medical system in Cuba works. And they compared Cuba's situation to other countries in Central and South America, or third world countries, Africa, Haiti, different places. And they see how they can make a difference. One of the things about medicine here is that you do a lot with a little bit. And it's like, I think that's what they're trying to teach us, that you don't have to be confined to working for a paycheck, but using the things that you know, using your knowledge to help a broad base of people. In that respect, I think that the intentions were pure.
How is socialist medical training different, both in the science of it and the social policy? I'm sure you know, and compare notes with medical students in the States. How is your path different?
Well, we are a lot different in that everything here is preventative care and community medicine. The way the health system is set up here is that there's a central hospital, that's where we train, and then in each community there's a doctor's office. So on each block, say it's an apartment building, an apartment complex, in the bottom of the apartment building complex will be the doctor's office. And that's where healthcare starts, in the community. So any pathology, any disease that somebody has, they have access to a doctor at their doorstep. House calls are made with regularity, both by the doctor and the nurses. If that patient that the doctor sees is a serious case, they get sent to the health center, the big hospital. We're taught preventative health. We're taught to diagnose a patient, okay, if they have liver disease. But what they really focus on, what caused that liver disease? What factors brought about this liver disease? For example, like if it's smoking or...
Have a devil rum.
Right. Is it congenital? Is it alcoholism? Is it something that we could have educated the patient about? Is it something like, and I feel that in the United States, and that when I talk to people, the United States is not about preventative medicine. It's not about, okay, let me teach you about diabetes so that you don't suffer the consequences of having diabetes. Whereas here, it starts there. Education, educating patients about the disease that they have so that they don't have to suffer the complications.
We hear that there's not enough medicine in Cuban medicine. I was urged to bring Advil, aspirin, Tylenol down for people in pain, and did. What do you find at the level of sort of real treatment medicines?
I'm sure that Cuba does lack medicines directly because of the embargo that is imposed by the United States, but they find ways around it. They produce their own medicines here. They produce their own vaccines here. They practice Oriental medicine, acupuncture, and things of the like. They also trade with Canada, pharmaceutical companies. So me personally, I can't say that I've seen a lack. Like, I can't say that I've treated a patient and wasn't able to prescribe them Advil, because maybe it's because they don't call it Advil here. They call it Duralgina, or they call it paracetamol. But those medications, they are here.
I was going to say that I actually buy my medications here before returning to the United States. For example, Claritin, I can get a pack of Claritin here for under $1, whereas at home, it's about $20. Also, inhalers, 50 cents. I mean, the prices are reasonable, and the medicines are of equal quality. And the fact that now that we've lived here for 4 years, that we don't have health insurance in the United States, I mean, just makes it that much more difficult to fill our medical needs at home. I do most of my medical care here in Cuba.
Wait till you come back to Cuba to get, you know, if you have to go get a physical exam, if you've been having this cough that's just, you just can't seem to, you know, get rid of at home, you wait till you come back to, you know, get your medications or to get your inhalations at the hospital. I actually know students, American students, who have gotten laser eye surgery here in Cuba and the corrective vision surgery here. I'm like, they just saved themselves $2,000. It's a good deal.
What's your experience as Black Americans with the racial divide here, the racial divide at home?
It's really different here because the Cuban population is a very racially mixed community. There's a large population of Black Cubans, white Cubans, and every shade in between. So I don't feel, I suppose, when I was in the United States, when I was studying, I was a science major in college, and I would be one of a very small number of Black, African, or Afro-Cuban, Afro-Caribbean students. Whereas here, I don't feel that way. Here, I can go into a lecture hall and a Black female professor will be giving me a lecture. Or if I go into surgery, I'll see a Black female surgeon heading up the surgery. I don't want to say that racism doesn't exist in Cuba. I feel that it, because it definitely does, but I feel that it exists in a very different way than it does in the United States.
Where do you see it here?
Let me explain it this way. In the United States, I feel that sometimes racism exists. It's institutionalized, right? Here, it's like, it's more, can I say social? It's more social. It's when somebody says to you, oh, you're not Black, you're mixed. Or they say, tú no eres negra, eres mulatica. And that's as if to say being Black is being somehow worse. Or they say, oh, find yourself a white man with light eyes and blonde hair so that your kids, you can adelantar the race, meaning you can push your kids forward, right? And you can better yourself, you can better your race if your kids will be better for that. And to that I say, so they'll say to their... they'll say to their father, look, Dad, you made me better. And then they'll say to me, look, Mom, you almost made me worse. You see what I'm saying? It's like, it's one of those things that, like, that's where racism exists. And it sometimes it actually does hurt. Sometimes it stings because there's such a huge population of Black people in Cuba. You wouldn't think that those remnants of, if it was colonialism or slavery, still held on. But they do. I cannot say that I see more white Cubans occupying positions of power or of, in terms of in the medical system or specialties, I think it might not be 50-50, but it's not 20-80. It might be 60-40. It might be 45-55. That'd be about right.
Therese, how do you see your relation to the Cuban Revolution? My impression is that the program you're in is proclaiming universal right to health as one of the new sort of humanist banners of the Cuban Revolution. How do you feel about your part in that?
I feel like we're here at a very important time in the history of the world. We're getting the type of education that I think is what people are looking for. More and more people are thinking very seriously about the idea of universal healthcare, about the idea of rights for everyone to basic access to healthcare. And I think we're going to be a huge part of that.
Akua, so is it fair to say that you're helping to, should we say, rebrand or fire up the Cuban Revolution, but it's something you might have wanted to do on your own?
I'm being from the Bay Area. I feel like we had an idealized version of what Cuba was like, and most people in other parts of the United States have a very pessimistic view of what Cuba is like, you know, highly militarized, that there aren't many freedoms, that they're very poor. And I think my role as a student here is to take everything that I have seen and experienced, the fact that Cuba is very advanced medically in terms of education, in terms of basic rights for their people, and sharing that with people back in the United States so that they can get an idea of the rights that they are, of what they should ask for, what they can ask for, what is possible for us as Americans working together as a community, what is possible. Like, for example, the educational system here is excellent. Everyone, there is very little homelessness. Everyone has the right to free health care, and not just in a basic sense, but to the most specialized needs. You know, neurosurgery, open heart surgery, costs nothing to the people. And the fact that a government with so little financial resources can do all of these things for its people says that the United States should be able to do not only this, but so much more.
Could I ask you a ridiculously big question?
Sure.
About the Cuban thing, the Cuban magic, the Cuban mystique? Always a fascinating country for the United States, going way, way, way back. Have you ever had moments when you thought, aha, I got it?
No, I don't think I've gotten it yet. I think, you know...
Is it out there?
Yes, it definitely is. I feel as if the Cuban mystique is related to the fact that it's such a mix of so many different cultures, and that escape from the control of what, like, the world machine, the fact that they have sort of chosen their destiny and chosen to live with the ideals that they proclaimed in the revolution, even though it means, you know, loss of a lot of resources and help economically and from around the world. The fact that they stood up to the, you know, Big Brother and the Old Boys Club, and they're very proud of that. From Cubans young and old are very proud of the fact that even though the United States has been against them and plotting against them for 50 years, that Cubans still stand strong, you know? And
please, you take it apart.
Let me dissect this thing. I think the Cuban mystique is, it's their willingness to live even though it means a struggle, their willingness to enjoy life, even though they're not enjoying life how maybe 90 miles off the coast, people in Miami are enjoying life. It's like this freedom that they have to express their joy, their pain, their sadness, and they do it through their music, through religion, through cultural, through, I guess, discussions and exchange with people, with in between between Cubans themselves and between other foreigners. For me, the Cuban mystique is the Santeria, the religion that they practice here. And the reason I say that is because it encompasses so much. It's a religion with its own rituals and customs and special holy days and things like that, but it's also in the music, it's in the movement of people. It's like it transfixes you. It's like the rumba. It's if anyone ever went to a Cuban rumba, it's there. It's in the air. It colors the air. It's something you can. It's almost tangible, that mystique in the beating of the drums and how it changes, how it affects all Cuban people. I mean, people who are distinctly European heritage, and people who have distinctly African heritage. It transfixes them, that the drums. I think that's what it is. I think she's looking at me crazy.
I'm just trying to think. Do you really think that?
Have you seen a 70-year-old Cuban grandmother whose mother was from Spain when they start playing rumba? Have you seen, like, she, all the years fall off and she's like, she's transformed. And I mean, for me, like, I see that in the context of Santeria and the Yoruba religion. But for me, that's like that's when you can see it in its most tangible form, the mystique, the music of Cuba. I think people are drawn to Cuba for many different reasons, but the music, the rhythm, the song, the vitality of the people here. And I think in some ways it's linked to the music and to the rumba and that aspect of it.
Should we talk about the hard parts? The tough days?
Yes, there are tough days. There have been a lot of tough days. I know there will be a lot more tough days. They're getting easier and they're coming, you know, they're sporadic now. I feel when I first got here, the hardest thing was communication back home. I'm very much connected to my family. They are a huge part of my success here. Their continued support, their prayers, they are who make Kay Shindana. They make me who I am, and their support allows me to succeed. And I found that I was just separated from that, and I would go a week without speaking to my mother or father. That was the hardest thing. In the second year, as I got more accustomed to living in Cuba and was able to, you know, do my own shopping and not have to worry about people thinking, trying to, you know, swindle me out of like a dime or 20 cents because I'm a foreigner. As I got more comfortable with speaking the Cuban dialect and interacting with the Cuban people, my struggle became that certain things are just not, you're not going to find certain things here. You're not going to find your peanut butter and jelly. I found them this year, so I'm very happy. But in my second year, it's like, you know, at home, how easy is it to get in a car and go to Walmart and find everything? Okay, I need some detergent. Let me go to aisle 6. All right, now I think I want some Doritos. Let me go to aisle 3. There are no Doritos here. No, there are no snacks. There is pan, cone, lechon. I didn't know there were that many ways to eat a pig, but there are a lot of ways to eat a pig. And it's like pan con lechon is a piece of bread with roasted pork, which sounds really good, except that there's the pork to fat ratio in the sandwich, not balanced. So, I mean, it's that. It was just the little, it was little inconveniences. What you find is that they pile up, and it becomes a straw that breaks the camel's back. You're just like, I just want some ketchup. I really just want some ketchup. That's all I want.
Therese, talk about the hard days.
I'm somebody who likes to be very efficient. You know, you make your to-do list. These are the things I'm going to do today, and I have X amount of time to do them, and it never works out that way here. Never. Don't think you're going to get everything done on your list, because something is always going to get in the way. Whether it's the amount of time that it takes to actually get somewhere, transportation here can be frustrating at times. It's gotten better, I think, in the last couple of years, because they've added more buses and things like that. But it's still, it's frustrating, you know, to
I think last year I needed a light bulb for my house, and it took me 3 hours to find a light bulb, and I had to go to 6 different stores.
Wow.
Yes.
Will somebody explain to me, what does Cuba and the revolutionary government have against toilet seats? Not to mention toilet paper.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know. What do they have against toilet seats?
I'm really not sure. I don't know why they're not included.
It's not a necessity. It's against the revolution. Anti-revolutionary.
I think we've all learned to kind of bring our toilet seats not around with us. But I bought a toilet seat here so that in my dorm room or in my house or whatever, I can have a toilet seat.
You brought it in your luggage from the States?
Yes.
Wow. Nobody told me.
No.
I would have brought 5 of them.
To share with friends, family, and friends. Other frustrations? You had stuff to say about the bureaucracy, you know? Same thing?
Oh, definitely. If you, for example, go into an office and have a question about something, at home, if the person that isn't responsible for that thing isn't there, usually there's someone else in the office that can help you, at least to a certain degree. Here, that's not the case. Everybody has their responsibility. Everybody has their role. And nobody steps on the role, I guess, of somebody else. So if I walk into an office and the person responsible for the thing that I need done is not there, it's just not getting done that day. I have to come back. And that can also get frustrating, especially if time is of the essence and you need something done in a timely manner. You learn to plan ahead. You learn to plan way ahead here and try to get things done really early. And you also definitely learn patience. As Keisha said, I am probably the most patient person in the world now. When I go home and people are yelling about having to wait in line, I wait quietly and I have no problems. I can wait in the airport for 6 hours now, and I, without a care in the world, I can probably just stare off into the distance and I'm fine. You know,
Exactly. On the handheld with the Bluetooth on, swerving, and then like now, my mom's like, "What happened to you? You used to be like a speed demon race car driver. Could you speed up?" My mama, who does not drive faster than 35 miles an hour, is telling me to. I was like, whoa.
Testify on the matter of Cuban sexism.
Even though you see women at all levels of academic and economic levels, at the same time, you can't go 2 blocks without being catcalled.
I've seen it even in the hospitals where patients will almost give less credit to the opinion of the female doctor, and look always, like their eyes will automatically gravitate towards the male doctor. You know, like, you tell me what's going on. It's not something that's like covert, it's open. You know, it's very definitely a sexist society.
Can I ask, how big a burden in the end? Or does it become part of the atmosphere?
I feel like at least here it's out in the open. You know, at home, it sexism still exists, and then people will try to hide it.
So that you can respond to it, right. And so that you can challenge them on their ideas, these backwards ideas that they carry. No matter what you say, you can come in and give a full introduction. Hi, my name is Akua Brown, and I'm a 4th-year medical student. So what do you study, nursing? No, I am a medical student. I study medicine. I am going to be a doctor. But what kind of doctor? You mean like a nurse, though, right? No, a doctor of medicine. Like this man who is standing right next to me. This man. I am going to be a doctor. Oh, well, that's great. That's wonderful. They let you do that? You know, just a sort of... It's sort of those things where you know... They know that women can do everything, but to actually see women doing everything, you know, on a daily basis for themselves is a shock to them, you know?
Not only Cuban men, but all Latino men and being American women. Oh, you guys are so independent and you're this and you do that by yourself? You drive?
you go out by yourself? You don't bring your boyfriend? No. I can do these things by myself. But the thing about what Ku was saying about, like, how come I can't walk down the street without a man, I think that's different. I feel like that's a Caribbean thing. I don't think it's sexism. I mean, I don't think it's sexism because the women do it to men, and it's like it's like they're complimenting you. They're not really. I get offended by it because I'm like, don't define me by how I walk. But it's like they're appreciating you. Some of them really do say it in a nice way, and they're just appreciating you. Some people take it too far, and you'll find that anywhere. You'll find that anywhere. You'll find that in the United States. You'll find that here. But I feel like it's a cultural custom, not necessarily sex. It's just a cultural custom to compliment beauty when you see it. But in terms of the women, you can't go out with your friends at night. What is that? They're so liberated in so many ways. It's just, to me, it's crazy that they're not liberated in that way as well. That, like, you won't see three women at night over drinks laughing about the day's events. You'll see them, one of them's in her house cleaning the floor, and the other ones are sitting in the portal and talking about day's events, but you're not going to see them in the cafe.
You might have been doctors trained in the United States. You know lots of doctors being trained in the United States. What are you going to do with this education, and how will it be different?
What this has taught me, and what it's continuing to teach me, is that you can find ways to think outside of the box. You can find ways to not circumvent the medical system in the United States, but provide care to people who really need it. You can change the world one patient at a time. It can happen. You being here allows me to say, I'm going to go back to the United States, and I have an interest in being in surgery, in cardiovascular surgery. Being here allows me to say I can go to whatever state in the United States, if it's in the Mississippi Delta, if it's in the middle of Fresno, if it's in Nevada, if it's under a rock in Idaho, I can go and I can help somebody. I don't have to worry about who I have to pay back, which creditor is going to be deducting money from my salary each month. Like, being here allows me to say I can be revolutionary in the United States. Not that I can be communist in the United States, but that I can revolutionize healthcare, even if it's only on my block, even if it's only in my clinic. My clinic can be a revolution. My clinic can help people. And I know that I'll have to find ways to, I'll have to find funding. I'll have to find ways to, you know, work around the healthcare system that's already set up. But being here shows me that it is possible. It is something that can be done. And, like, that's what I bring back. I'm not going to say that I'm going to come back and I have to work in New York or I have to. I mean, I need to be by my family. But what I realize is that if you are willing to work without thinking about what you're going to get from it, it's so much more satisfying. Being here has taught me that one of the things that has taught me is that I am a member of the global community, and that not only that I'm a member of the global community, I feel that, like, in the United States, you go through high school, you go through college, and it's like there's a set path that you have to take. Being here has shown me that you can come off the beaten trail and create your own and just be a trailblazer on your own. I think it has instilled in me that trust and that faith in myself, that I'm seeing it being manifested here, the caring for people in need without the crush of how much it's going to cost. And it's something that I can bring back with me to the United States. And not having the debt that most medical students incur allows me the opportunity to say, wherever I am needed, I can go and I can do this and I can start it small. It's like here they teach you how to be your self-sufficient doctor. Okay, so your lung just collapsed and I have a pair of scissors and a plastic bag. Well, let's fix your lung with a pair of scissors and a plastic bag, right? And what? Like, right? We're MacGyvers here. And I know, like, how much do we have in the United States? How much do we have to work with in the United States? I mean, the possibilities when we get home are limitless. And I just feel like we need to stay connected to the students that are here, stay connected to what's going on here, to allow what we learn to be manifested in the United States.
Carice, same question. How is Dr. Carice Gayle going to be affected, changed, directed by this experience?
We learn how to diagnose our patients with our hands, our ears, our eyes, more so than with technology, x-rays, CT scans, because you don't end up doing those kind of really costly costly labs as often here. So we definitely have that as an advantage. That, I mean, just comparing, I actually did an observership at some of the Emory University pediatric hospitals this past summer, and I was actually able to kind of compare and contrast the way that we learn how to do medicine here and the way that it's done in hospitals in the United States. And in the United States, labs are very heavily relied upon. I didn't see as much patient contact. The residents that I shadowed didn't seem to be as comfortable talking to patients and their, well, it was pediatric, so their mothers or their fathers, as I was, because we're given just that day-to-day patient contact. We learn how to interview our patients thoroughly and how to do a really thorough physical exam and do it well, and to be comfortable with that. And I thought...
You don't have an insurance company looking over your shoulder either.
Exactly. No. Which is
I think that's one of the best parts, because it allows us as students to do more without fear. Like, they give us more opportunities to take chances and even to make mistakes, because they are there supervising us, and at the same time, they don't have insurance companies looking over their shoulders. And patients are happy to have us learn from them and learn with them, because they know how important education is and medicine is here in the Cuban system. You know, I feel like I've gotten to do so many things that I would never have a chance to do at home as a fourth-year medical student. Surgeries, yeah. And different being parts of different exams, doing ultrasounds, taking blood, doing examinations head to toe alone, and coming up with my own ideas, forming my own ideas about the diagnosis, and then checking in with our professors to make sure that we're on the right track. You know, I feel.
So, but Akua, you come back to the United States as an MD.
Okay.
How long will you be different, and what will the difference be?
I hope it will be permanent. I hope that, I mean, because I see my role as a doctor as not just being the person in the hospital waiting for the patients to come to me, but as being an active leader in my community. I mean, I feel like what I've learned from medicine here in Cuba are that the people who you can help the best, who you can have the largest impact on, are people... And you're already there. The people right around you, yes, the people who surround you, because it's with them that you do have the day-to-day contacts, and by communication and getting to know people, you know, on a more personal level, they are more likely to understand that you do care for them and take your opinions more seriously, into account, you know? I think community.
Doctors here, not only do they do house visits, but they go into homes. They have a form that they fill out where you can check off what risk factors this person has, from just going into their house and seeing, you know, is their water contained properly? Do they have pets? Do they smoke inside the house, outside the house? You know, so having that kind of, that first-hand, like, view. In the United States, you can ask someone, do you smoke inside of your house?
or, you know, do you have a pet? And they can easily lie to you. But here, as someone's primary physician, no, you actually see what is going on in someone's home life. And not only just the purely physical medical aspects, but also the psychological aspects as well. You know, what kind of family problems, do you feel tension as soon as you walk in the door? You know, is this a kind of a mentally healthy environment, or do we need to get these people seeing a psychologist? Or, you know, there's so many advantages to this system, I think, that we will be able to hopefully take back and try to apply in the communities where we live.
And I think Keisha did mention as well that without the debt that most medical students graduate with, that we won't be afraid to start our own projects and start our own programs and work without necessarily needing the money, needing money to pay back the loans and the things that are hanging over our heads. And I think living here for 6 years, we've learned how to live a simpler life, you know? Yeah. With bare necessities. I don't have a car. I ride the bus. I hitchhike, you know, buying from the community market. I don't...
And you're not complaining.
And I'm not complaining. I mean, home is comfortable, but here is livable, and it's possible. I know I can do it. If it's what I need to reach my goals or to reach my dreams or whatever I have, my plan is, it's possible. It's able. I'm able to do with less.
Yeah. Akur, Therese, Keisha, it's a thrill to hear your story. I think you're a blessing for Cuba. Cuba's been a blessing to you. We want to hear the next chapters, but this has been so much fun. Thank you.
Yay. No, thank you.
Thank you.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation for Open Source. There's more to come from Cuba, more music, and more reflections on the revolution at 50. Please join the extended conversation about Cuba on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for listening.